You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up following this weekend's deadly mass shooting in El Paso, the Mexican government is demanding that the U.S. better protect Mexican citizens and Mexican Americans. We'll learn more about the relationship between the two countries in the aftermath of the shooting. Now it's time for our weekly state news roundup. We're checking in with reporters about the stories they've been covering around Wisconsin. First, a major storm made its way across the northern half of the state this Wednesday, with several tornadoes touching down. Some of the worst damage was in Green Bay, where 14,000 people lost electricity. Since then, crews have worked overtime to clear the streets and bring back power. Doug Schneider is a reporter and government watchdog for the Green Bay Press Gazette. Doug, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, this storm moved across the northern half of Wisconsin back on Wednesday. What can you tell us about what it did when it hit Brown County?
It got through the western half of the county pretty much okay, dumping a lot of rain and lightning and things like that. And then once it crossed the East River and or the Fox River in Green Bay, things got a little hairy. The winds picked up and some trees and telephone poles went down, and it turned out we had an EF5 tornado.
Yeah, confirmed tornado setting. And did I read in your reporting 2 inches of rain in 2 hours at one point?
That's correct. I mean, cats and dogs and everything else you can think of. It was just, it was soaking, and being out in it, you could feel the weight of it hitting you. It was like somebody pouring a bucket of water on your head from a ladder.
Talk about some of the damage in the area. I know power outages. Can you talk about that and whatever else happened then?
We had at one point 14,000 homes and businesses without power, and it was sort of atypical in that it was dozens, if not more, isolated outages. So that was a little bit challenging for WPS to get things restored. The other issue was with trees. A number of those down, you could kind of trace the path that the storm followed. And I'd been driving over from the west side of the city and managed to miss it. And then a couple blocks from my home, I turned down the street. And in the span of 2 blocks, there were about 10 trees down.
And this isn't the first big storm you've had. Just a couple few weeks ago, right? You had another big storm hit Green Bay.
And we had a handful this summer, and it's created some unusual situations. A couple of the early ones caused some flooding, you know, some filled basements and some damage to homes along the East River, again on the southeast side of the city. This one did not. The river levels rose fairly quickly, but we did not get reports of any sort of significant flooding. There were some folks who had water in their basement, but much less devastating than previously.
And you mentioned 14,000, close to 14,000 people lost their power. Where are we now in bringing power back to people?
Everything's pretty much back except for isolated cases. I'm looking at the outage map now, and it says there are 58 customers in Green Bay and one up in Langlade County, and that's about it for the WPS service area. The utility had said that things would be back, mainly back to normal, no later than yesterday afternoon, and that's been pretty much true.
Doug, thanks a lot for joining us, and I wish you mellow weather for the rest of August.
Thanks so much.
Doug Schneider is a reporter and government watchdog with the Green Bay Press Gazette. He joined us for an update on the recovery from a big storm this week that left thousands in the city without power. Now, two brothers from Shawano County have been missing for more than 2 weeks. Justin and Nick Diemel disappeared while on a business trip in Bramer, Missouri. The brothers are now believed to be dead, and police have taken one person into custody on charges related to the disappearance. Katie Bernard is a reporter covering crime, police, and courts for the Kansas City Star. She's been following this story. Katie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is a strange story, a tragic story. I know a lot of people in Shawano County following this closely, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But can you take us back to late last month and the events that led to this disappearance?
Yeah, absolutely. So from what we know at this point, the Diemel brothers have owned a livestock company for about 4 years and have cows kind of across the Midwest, including in Missouri. And they went down to went down to Missouri on a business trip, and one of their last stops was at this farm in northwest Missouri in Bramer, Missouri, where Garland Nelson, who's now charged in connection with the case, works. and they were then reported missing on July 21st around 11:30 a.m. when their family realized they weren't answering their phones anymore, and they ended up missing their flight back to Wisconsin. So that was the point at which the missing persons report was filed. And then the rental truck was found at a commuter lot in Holt, Missouri, which is about 35 miles southwest of the farm, the following Monday.
And then how did the investigation play out after that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So once the rental truck was found, that really kicked off the search. We didn't hear much between that point and the next week when the between the point that Monday when the truck was found and then that next Friday, Garland Nelson, who's a 25-year-old from Bremer, Missouri, was charged with tampering with the pair's rental truck. The truck is seen on surveillance video being driven without a passenger between Bremer and Holt, and Nelson later admits in court documents to moving the vehicle. And so it's on that same day that it's determined a death investigation rather than a missing persons investigation. The following Tuesday, police told us that human remains were found on the farm where Nelson worked, that last farm that the brothers were known to be at. And at that point, it's kind of where the investigation has left off. We haven't had any updates since that point. And to our knowledge at this point, the human remains have not been identified yet.
And as I understand it, the brothers from Wisconsin, now tragically feared dead, apparently had a business deal involving this Garland Nelson?
Yes, that is our understanding. I spoke to Garland Nelson's mother last week, and she told me that the brothers were in town to look at some calves that they were taking care of and feeding for the brothers.
Now, you came up to Wisconsin and visited with people in Shawnee County, of course, family members devastated by this. What did you hear from the community in Shawnee County as they followed this story?
Yeah, the community in Shawnee County was largely, they were in shock, but they weren't in shock that was going to let them stand still. It was a large number of people that in some way, shape, or form knew the Demo family because it's a big family in a set of small towns. And so they were coming together to do anything they could to support the family, was what I saw.
What kind of efforts did that involve?
Yeah, it was wide-ranging. There was one farmer who owned a U-Pick farm and took a day and donated all proceeds from the farm to the family, and then challenged any company to match his donation, which ended up being a concrete company. And then a local baseball team, the Navarino Rangers, took a game that was one of their biggest games of the year and donated all proceeds from the gate, ran a raffle, and raised additional funds, and ended up raising about $7,000 for the family. I've also seen a haircut-a-thon being promoted on Facebook and multiple members of the community individually auctioning off different items with the intention of donating whatever money they earn back to the family.
Of course, it's a tragedy, the apparent loss of the Demo brothers here. Was it also shocking, the sense of mystery and uncertainty at this point about what exactly happened?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, any sort of loss like this is tragic and shocking, but the unknown makes it even worse. I had the opportunity to sit down and speak with their family, and I know I spoke to Nick's wife, and she told me that the unknown makes it so much more horrific because she has nightmares about what may have happened, and it could be a really long time before we're going to have any clue what really happened to these two.
And what kind of memories did people share about the Demo brothers?
Yeah, it was memories of two really, from what I could tell, genuine, fun-loving guys. Both Lisa Demo and Taylor Mueller. Taylor was Justin's girlfriend and Lisa was Nick's wife, had known the two since they were teenagers, and were able to share both memories of them as children, as well as a lot of memories of hunting with them and date nights and time that they spent with Nick's children.
And Katie, as we wrap up, what are you watching for next in this investigation and possible charges?
Yeah, it's hard to say with charges at this point because it seems like there's still, you know, a lot going on with the investigation. What I'm wondering if we will hear next is identification of the human remains that were found on the farm. That'll give us a good point in the direction of where this investigation is going.
Katie, thanks a lot for talking with us today.
Thank you. Have a good day.
That's Katie Bernard, reporter for the Kansas City Star. She joined us to talk about the investigation into the disappearance of two Wisconsin brothers from Shawnee County in the Kansas City area last month as part of our weekly roundup of news affecting people around Wisconsin. 22 people were killed this weekend at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas. 24 people were also injured in the attack. When the perpetrator surrendered to law enforcement, he told authorities that he was targeting Mexicans. That's according to reports out today. 8 Mexican citizens were killed in the attack. Another 6 were injured. In response, the Mexican government demanded that the U.S. take steps to protect its citizens, and Mexican leaders called the shooting an act of terror. Our next guest is here to talk about the relationship between Mexico and the United States and whether the Mexican government can demand the perpetrator's extradition. Anthony Wayne Fontes is an assistant professor for the School of International Service at American University. Anthony, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
Well, this shooting in El Paso has gotten attention from the Mexican government. What kind of things are we hearing at the highest levels from Mexico?
Well, Mexico has been making some noise about the possibility of a request to extradite the alleged perpetrator, Crucius, in this case, which is something that really hasn't happened in Mexico-U.S. relations ever.
And talk about this border area. This is a place people up here in Wisconsin might not think about it. This is a place where people might cross the border from Mexico to the United States, as some of the victims sadly did, just to go shopping. They might bop up for a day.
Right. El Paso, like a lot of other cities along the U.S.-Mexico border, is very much a binational city. It's a border city. Something like 6 out of 10 El Paso people who live in El Paso have family on the other side of the border in Ciudad Juarez, which is its sister city. Many people in Ciudad Juarez have family in El Paso. And these are relationships and familial social relationships that go back generations and are really key to not only the social and cultural aspects of El Paso, but also its economic lifeline. Many people come from Mexico to go shopping in the Walmart where people were shot. El Paso is proud of its binational history, and it's a very deep part of that city, which is important to understand, I think, in some of the claims that Mexico is making about trying to defend its people, because even people in El Paso feel a very deep connection to Mexico and because of that history.
Can you put this in the context of the relations between Mexico and the United States, especially since the presidency or during the presidency of Donald Trump?
Right. So, you know, Mexico is really taking a beating, especially the new president known as AMLO, President López Obrador, who came to power shortly around the same time that Trump did. And Mexico is really taking a beating from the U.S. government over its stance on immigration of the Central American migrants through its territory. And really, since Trump got to the presidency, he's done a lot of things to humiliate the present administration in Mexico and a wide swath of the Mexican population in essentially forcing Mexico to back up U.S. plans to keep Central Americans out, making Mexico do the dirty work with the threat of cutting off Mexico's access to U.S. markets upon which their economy deeply depends. So in many ways, you know, this gesture, this effort at extradition is a symbolic gesture. Legally, it has very little standing and very little likelihood of actually passing. But in demanding extradition, or at least threatening to ask for extradition, the president of Mexico and the president administration can make some gestures to a domestic audience that they are standing up for the rights of Latinos and are not just going to roll over as they have on many other issues.
We're talking to Anthony Wayne Fontes from American University, looking at the Mexican government's reaction to the shooting in El Paso. Victims included Mexican citizens in El Paso. Anthony, the extradition isn't the only action Mexican leaders, the foreign minister and the president, have taken. They've also called on the United States to do more to protect Mexican nationals in this country. What does that mean?
In in many ways, Mexico is picking up where many people on the left side of the political spectrum in the U.S. noises that have already been calls that have already been made from that side for a long time, highlighting the deeply sort of racist and divisive language used by the Trump administration and by Trump himself, especially in his campaign rallies, and really trying to highlight the racial and ethnic aspect of these of the recent massacres that have happened, of this particular massacre, and to try to join the chorus of voices that accusing the Trump administration of being overtly racist and not doing enough to discourage these sort of hate crimes that have been proliferating over the last 3 years or so. In many ways, this is an opportunity for the Mexican government to stick one to Trump and the Trump administration without having to risk as much as it does in its other negotiations with the Trump administration.
Now, the American government, in the case of, say, a terrorist attack in another country that took the lives of American citizens, it would be likely to express an interest in that attack to take precautions to secure the lives of American citizens. This is what governments do, right? They try to protect their citizens in their own borders and beyond.
Right. Absolutely. And the reason this might, this might seem strange coming from Mexico is that historically, Mexico hasn't stood up to the U.S. as much in these cases. People aren't extradited from U.S. into Mexico. U.S. has been extraditing plenty of criminals or alleged criminals from Mexico, especially since the war on drugs has heated up since the late 1990s, early 2000s. El Chapo Guzman is probably the most famous example of that because of the problems that Mexico has had in prosecuting high-level narco-traffickers. But it's not ever run in the other direction. And so in this case, Mexico is trying to show itself as sort of standing up to the U.S., which has historically acted, is acting as something of a bully in terms of Mexico's internal politics right now.
On a related note, I've heard concerns that here in the United States, we pay attention to drugs coming across the border from Mexico into the United States. We don't talk as much about the flow the other way, guns going from north to south into Mexico. How big a point of concern is that for the Mexican government?
Well, this is I think a deep misunderstanding of the dynamics of drug war in Mexico. While the actual individual violent actors and the flow of cocaine is emerging from and through Mexico, the money and the weapons, money that that these cartels earn through selling drugs, all comes from the U.S. And the weapons with which they arm themselves and overwhelm state forces are all bought in the U.S. because of lax U.S. gun laws, especially in border states. So it's a huge concern for the Mexican government. And along with parallel to the ongoing debate over gun laws in the U.S., Mexico has a stake in the massive proliferation of these sorts of military-style guns that have really taken the drug war in Mexico to new heights of violence.
Getting back to the Mexican government reaction now to the El Paso shooting and the victims, some of them being Mexican citizens, what are you watching for next as figures from the Mexican president, foreign minister to the Mexican ambassador to the U.S. are raising attention on this issue? What are you watching for next between the two countries?
Well, I think the one big stick that the Trump administration has against Mexico is Mexico's dependence on U.S. To sell to U.S. markets. It's U.S. is Mexico's biggest trading partner, and the threat of tariffs in the past on U.S. On goods made in Mexico going into the U.S. was enough to get Mexico to roll over. So I would say that Mexico will keep on making some noise along these lines, but not enough and won't actually take any decisive actions that would further threaten this very already tenuous trade relations with the U.S. So I don't expect a whole lot along this vein, except for more symbolic discourse rather than actual action.
Anthony, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Anthony Wayne Fontes is an assistant professor for the School of International Service at American University. He joined us today to talk about the Mexican government's call for the U.S. government to better protect Mexican citizens and Mexican Americans following last weekend's deadly mass shooting in El Paso. July, according to preliminary numbers, is going to be the hottest month on record. And the United Nations is out with a new report that raises some big questions about the effect of agriculture on climate change and vice versa. The report comes from the International Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC. It says the way we use the world's land, like farming, cutting down forests, account for nearly a quarter of global human greenhouse gas emissions. The report also says a changing climate could put the world's food supply at risk. Chris Kucharik is a professor and chair of UW-Madison's Department of Agronomy and a professor of environmental studies. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, on the cause side of things, I think people, when they think about climate change, think about power plants and cars and burning fossil fuels. They don't necessarily think about farming, agriculture, and land use. Can you talk about the role they can play in causing climate change?
Sure. I think the first fact to point out is that up until about World War II, land use around the globe was really one of the primary contributors to buildup of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And it wasn't until after World War II that fossil fuel emissions began to greatly outpace land use change. But, you know, what does land use change actually mean? It's doing things like deforestation, cutting down forests. There's a carbon that's locked up in plants and soils that gets released back to the atmosphere, CO2, that had maybe been stored there for hundreds of thousands of years.
CO2 is the ingredient a lot of people think about with climate change, but it sounds like when it comes to agriculture, methane is a big pollutant that people are worried about.
Right. Methane, due to animal agriculture, methane is also a more potent greenhouse gas than CO2 on a molecule-per-molecule basis, and there's also nitrous oxide, which is a byproduct oftentimes of adding inorganic fertilizers to the soil to grow crops.
You mentioned animal agriculture, and I think sometimes people kind of laugh at, animals, livestock burping is causing climate change. But to talk about when you've got the number of livestock we've got on the planet, the impact that can have.
Right. We're talking about large numbers, and, animals themselves are part of the equation. There are certain crops that we grow under certain conditions also that can release methane from soils due to the conditions that they're exposed to. But yeah, you add up the number of animals we have on the planet and, every little bit ends up being a pretty large amount.
Let's get into that report a little bit. It's a big report. It talks about the impact of the methane. What are some of your key takeaways from agriculture and land use in this report and how it plays into climate change?
Well, I think the first thing that I took note of is that, we really need a radical transformation of global land use and our food systems. And, these IPCC reports come out pretty regularly. And I think this was the first time that a really strong message was sent about the role of land use change and its impacts on the climate system, and that we really need to make some changes soon.
What are some of the biggest changes that they point to that could make a difference?
Better management of our soils is probably one of the key things we can do in ways that we're not releasing CO2 that's tied up in plants and soils back to the atmosphere. The deforestation problem that we see in the Amazon and how we're clearing large tracts of land so we can, basically grow more animals on that land and pastures is a big loss to the point that, we could create an area of the earth that could be resembling more like a desert, a very dry region once you go through those changes.
Right. A phrase that keeps coming up in the report is desertification.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You lose plants are very good at, basically recycling water that falls as rainfall through something we call evapotranspiration that can have a cooling effect that's good for, certain areas, and, land use change can greatly impact the climate system. And I think that's one thing people have to remember is that, changes in climate will impact how your plants grow in your backyard, but vice versa on a global scale, the third of the planet that's growing crops and animals basically has a significant impact on the climate system.
Talking to Chris Kucharik from UW-Madison's Department of Agronomy. He's also a professor of environmental studies looking at a new report from UN on agriculture, land use, and climate change. Agriculture can be a contributor to climate change, and it can be damaged by climate change. And let's look at that flip side of this report, Chris, talking about how our food systems, the food we grow and eat, could be damaged by climate change.
Yeah. We're becoming more and more worried about simultaneous crop failures in different regions with a changing climate. meaning we've got certain regions that are key suppliers of staple crops of, you know, wheat and rice and, let's say, soybeans and corn. And as the climate continues to change and we have more and more extreme weather events, some of these might happen simultaneously in different areas of the planet and could completely devastate certain food supplies in certain years, which is a really big problem. And, you know, on a local to regional scale, dealing with more floods and more droughts and extreme heat are all really not good things when it comes to managing our crops and growing food.
Right. We do have extreme weather events already, but the hope is, okay, if Wisconsin's corn crop is damaged by flooding, Iowa's might be okay. What happens if you start seeing both of them hit at the same time?
Right. And I think we saw a lot of that this spring with the catastrophic flooding, you know, a delay in spring, you know, farmers planting some corn into July. I mean, these are unprecedented events. And, you know, my worry is that, you know, as we have more frequent events like that, it's not going to be that a farmer faces an extreme event once every 20 or 30 years. It might be once every other year. And they just aren't going to be able to recover from some of those sequence of events in multiple years.
Let's get into some more of the recommendations from the report. One that's got a lot of attention is saying, hey, people of the world, especially people in more advanced countries, higher wealth countries, you can make a difference here by changing what you eat and how much of different types of food you eat. What are they looking at?
Yeah, eating less meat. Like, that seems to be the easy one that everyone points to. And it's the obvious answer that you'll hear because people will say, well, if you're eating beef from cows, well, cows obviously give off methane. That's a greenhouse gas. But there's really more to the story than that. I mean, it's really about the amount of land and feed that's needed to produce that meat. You know, a large percentage of what we grow as corn in the U.S. goes to feeding animals, unfortunately. So if we can start to divert some of that land away, you know, due to less meat being needed, we can do better things with that land and maybe sequester carbon on that landscape.
And this IPCC report doesn't say everybody go vegan tomorrow, no. Right? What are they suggesting for people?
You know, probably a better mix, a more healthy, you know, diet. I think, you know, there's a win-win here for human health as well as the climate system. You know, obviously we have rising obesity rates. A lot of this is connected to, you know, the way food is just rapidly and quickly available and processed. And so more plant-based, you know, just eating more of those things is obviously going to be better.
It sounds like a really small change for one person to make. Is this something that if we had a culture change where we changed our diet to, I think, the equivalent of 1.5 hamburgers a week being the amount of beef people might be shooting for, if that becomes a norm, is that really enough to put a significant dent in our emission numbers?
Yeah, I believe so. I think, you know, those small choices add up when you're talking about the number of people that might consume, you know, that amount. And there's just a lot of small things I think that people can do and probably have to take a good look in the mirror about, you know, their own desires and needs, you know, from a dietary standpoint. And one of the things that, you know, we find is that some of the environmental issues that we've created, unfortunately, through agricultural land management, like the water quality issues, people like cheese, ice cream, pizza. To have that stuff means you need to, unfortunately, grow a lot of, you know, animals and cows and that. And sometimes those two things don't go together very easily.
One of our reporters got a reaction to the report from Darren Von Ruden with the Wisconsin Farmers Union. He was definitely interested in some of the recommendations of the report, but he was worried about some of the recommendations that came to dairy and beef here in Wisconsin. Here's a listen to some of what he had to say.
As a dairy producer and a beef producer, is there enough fruits and vegetables out there to feed the world or not?
So do we have the capacity to feed the world in a different way than we're doing right now?
Well, I think we do. I think what people generally point to is that it's, you know, we're producing enough. It's just the distribution of food that is the key problem here. And, you know, there are other ways to grow animals. We don't have to be necessarily feeding them lots of corn grain. We're starting to see more shifts to regenerative agriculture, an idea of getting animals back on the landscape and growing perennial grasses and having them graze more, sort of the way we may have been doing things a long time ago. And those types of ideas help regenerate the soil, sequester carbon a bit better than our current system. So I don't think it's like completely saying, you know, we're going to get rid of those animals. There's just a better way to think about how we can grow them and treat our natural resources a bit better.
Talking to Chris Kucharik with UW-Madison's Department of Agronomy and the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, looking at a new report from the United Nations on how farming, agriculture, our use of land impacts, increases climate change, and how climate change could affect our food supply in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the findings of this report and what you've heard about it? Have you changed your diet? Would you consider changing your diet to be a little more plant-based over time? Could you see yourself reducing the amount of meat that you eat? If you work in agriculture, what are the challenges that come with making sustainability a bigger focus of your operation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now about a new UN report that looks at how our use of land impacts global climate change. Chris Kucharik is with us, professor of agronomy and environmental studies at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. This report looks at the ways that food production, among other things, can contribute to climate change and how climate change can impact our food system. What do you want to see change when it comes to this report, when it comes to sustainable agriculture? If you're a farmer yourself, could you get on board with some of the changes you're hearing about? If you eat food, I imagine you do, are you thinking about making a change in what you eat with the climate in mind? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let's bring on a caller now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I realize trees pull in a lot of carbon dioxide, which is good. But then when the leaves fall off and they rot, does that release methane? And as a result, well, what should we do about the leaves or do with the leaves?
So good question, Dennis. So actually, when leaves fall and you have decomposition, that's actually CO2 that is released as a byproduct due to microbes basically chomping on that material. So there's typically not methane involved. Methane is typically coming from wetlands that may be drained, you know, to grow crops, but it's usually not a concern given the carbon cycle with trees.
The report does talk some about not just deforestation, but reforestation. And I've heard a proposal lately, something like if the world could plant, I think the number was a trillion or so trees, it could make a difference for climate change. It may not be as easy as that, though. What is the role of reforestation here, Chris?
Well, yeah, you know, anytime you're putting something that's taking up CO2 from the atmosphere, and trees obviously are a great way and have lots of different other environmental benefits, but you have to think about where are those trees being planted? Are they displacing crops off of, you know, good soils and putting crops onto more highly erodible soils or degraded soils? It's not always a simple solution when you're talking about the total sheer amount of trees that it might take and, you know, where we're actually going to end up putting those.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Greg with us in Mineral Point. Greg, hi.
Good afternoon. Good topic. I just wanted to make a comment as far as changing people's diets from corn-fed beef to grass-fed beef. Supply and demand has a lot to do with that. I grow grass-fed beef if I thought I could have a market for it, where, like, I could make a money or make a living doing that.
Greg, thanks for the call. Is there a demand? Will consumers buy sustainable products, Chris, even if maybe they're more expensive?
Yeah, I think right now they're more expensive, and you know you can see them at the supermarket. I think it's a gradual change that has to just happen, you know, over time. And I think to transform agriculture and the system that we're in now to something that we desire, there's going to have to be some incentives, some sort of programs that allow farmers to take that risk to move from what they're doing now to something in the future that we'd like them to do. And I think we're kind of waiting for someone in leadership, you know, in the political arena to stand up and make a bold statement and goal that gets us there.
Are you seeing much of that, the bold statements?
No, I haven't. But I think, you know, as time goes on, we're seeing, you know, more and more of the red flags going up and saying we really need to act. You know, reports like this are one way of getting people talking, you know, about it.
Thanks a lot for that call. John joins us now in Oconomowoc. John, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, John?
Good. Well, I am a dairy farmer from Oconomowoc, and I'm out on my tractor right now and heard your program. There has been some data put out in regards to greenhouse gas production in the United States from agriculture versus the whole world. And those numbers, which come from EPA and UC Davis, seem to indicate that agriculture would put out somewhere less than 10% of our greenhouse gas emissions here in the United States in a developed country. And I would like the professor to comment on that versus a whole world scenario, which the UN frequently looks at.
John, thanks a lot for the call. So do we know the proportion of agriculture in the U.S. in particular when it comes to climate change emissions?
I think we do. Unfortunately, I don't have the statistics off the top of my head, but I think, you know, we're pretty much, you know, on par. We do certainly grow similar types of crops as I do in other types of the world, have similar management practices. But yeah, I'm sorry I don't have the exact numbers there to cite.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. When it comes to per capita emissions, not just talking about agriculture, but in general, like a lot of times people stack the U.S. against countries like China or India. When it comes to a per person basis, how do we Americans stack up against the rest of the world? Not so much at exact numbers, but ballpark.
Yeah, we're not good. We're still, you know, near the top in terms of total emissions and that. And it's, you know, you hear about these other countries that are more rapidly developing that are doing worse than we are, and then it always comes back to us. Well, then why are we the ones that have to set the standard and be the leaders on this? And I'm like, well, we have to be. You know, we're looked at and viewed as a world leader in a lot of different areas, and this is just one other area that we can be good in.
Talking about a new report on agriculture and climate change, how agriculture contributes to climate change, how a changing climate could impact, maybe hurt agriculture in the long run. That report from the United Nations. Chris Kucharik is with us, professor of agronomy and environmental studies at UW-Madison. I often ask people who study climate change about their relative levels of optimism when it comes to reining in the rate of climate change. Where are you on optimism, pessimism here?
I'm still optimistic. I think that's just my very nature as my personality, given all the other problems we're trying to work on, too. But I think, you know, this is in the discussion so much now that people are really learning more. They're understanding more. I guess my concern is that it's hard to talk to the everyday person and explain to them how climate change impacts their daily life. And there's not enough examples where I think people feel like, oh, yeah, that particular event, that was climate change, and I was, you know, impacted this way. So we still have a ways to go, but I'm still fairly optimistic we'll get there.
Let's go back to our callers now. Peter is with us in Viola. Peter, hi.
Hi there.
What'd you want to tell us about, Peter?
Well, I just wanted to throw in a little comment here about the role of managed grazing in building soil and sequestering carbon in the agricultural landscape.
Yeah, is this something you work in, Peter?
Yes, so we have a 220-acre farm here in southwest Wisconsin where we raise cattle and sheep and pigs and goats and chickens, and we rotate them through our pastures very rapidly. So every group spends about a day in one place, and then we give each paddock a long rest, 30 to 40 days. And when we come back, that gives all the biology a chance to rest. The plants grow a lot. And then every time we graze, we're trampling vegetation, which is building soil, and also plant grass roots often will slough off when they get grazed, which builds soil kind of from the bottom up and the top down. And we've documented here on our farm, in the past 5 years, we've built 3 inches of topsoil just through managed grazing.
Peter, thank you so much for sharing your experience there. You were touching on that. There can be kinds of agriculture, even animal agriculture, that build soil and trap greenhouse gas emissions.
Exactly. That's the exact kind of story we need to multiply by, you know, certain orders of magnitude, you know, the 90 million acres of corn and beans, you know, that we might be, you know, trying to grow here. I mean, these are great examples, great stories, and there's more and more of these that we keep hearing about.
In our last, thanks a lot for that call. In just our last few moments, Chris, what do you hope that policymakers, in particular government leaders, take and do with this report on agriculture from the United Nations?
I think first they need to understand that, you know, we know a lot about the system. There's a lot of facts, a lot of things we know. There's some things we don't know yet. You know, I'd like to continue to see more, you know, resources put into research and funding available so we can continue to answer those questions. But I'll go back to a statement I made before that someone's got to stand up and make a bold statement or goal to reach, whether it's some type of measurable change that we can work towards rather than just talking about it. So that's my hope.
Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great. My pleasure. Great to be here.
That's Chris Kucharik, professor and chair of UW-Madison's Department of Agronomy and professor of Environmental Studies. He was with us today to talk about a new report from the UN's International Panel on Climate Change that says there need to be some big changes in land uses like agriculture to avoid some of the worst effects of climate change. That report, as we've heard, also has recommendations for the future of agriculture. Coming up Monday at Central Time, Wisconsin is kicking off a new effort to create awareness of elder abuse and to help stop it from happening. We'll dig into the problem and some possible solutions. UW researchers have invented a new virtual camera that can help people see around corners. How does it work? I don't know. We'll talk to one of the researchers. And we'll meet eight women who paved the way for popular music in the United States and check out a new NPR project featuring their lives and their music. That, look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time.